So, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. So it is. So I'm going to do a quick review. Do you have that book on the Tara Tantras that...
Yes, do you know where it is? The red cover one?
On the Taras that this came from?
Trig knows where it is when he wakes up.
No, I don't.
I'll go look for it, sis.
Thank you. Meanwhile, we'll just do a quick review. I've been talking about the qualities of arising yoga and how you use it in your life. And I read a quote from Lama Yeshe that's in this. Do you know the Liberation Calendar? They put it out every year, FPMT, and basically what it is it supports programs to teach meditation and supply Buddhist books to people in jail. And it's part of Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe's work. And it's really a wonderful project. So it's a Tibetan-style calendar that has all of the Tibetan days on it for those of you who are doing some kind of pledge thing with, you know, on these days I should be doing this soap and on those days I should be doing this puja and stuff like that. And if you know anything about the Tibetan calendar, you know that every once in a while they miss a day and every once in a while they double a day. So it'll be what? First, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, tenth, ninth. So it's nice to have a Tibetan calendar if you're supposed to be following some schedule with some meditation you're doing. And it has things like when His Holiness the Dalai Lama's 70th birthday was, and, you know, little details like that, and the moon phases. And then these beautiful... pictures, beautiful, isn't that a beautiful Amitabha? Mm-hmm. And then little quotes, like here's Lama Yeshe, the reason you see yourself as a deity, because when you're doing Tibetan meditation, some of you know, some of you don't know, you imagine yourself by letting go of your usual image, by recalling that you're actually just full of holes, and so you focus on the fact, on the holes rather than the form, which is called hollow body practice. And then when you let go of your usual intention of yourself, then you start allowing yourself to arise as some kind of very compassionate being or a being who can call on the power of the ancestors from way back or the intention of manifestation on earth or whatever. If you're doing White Tara, or you can call on how to direct the energy for the benefit of all beings if you're doing Green Tara, or, you know, you can call on how to be the clear mind in the winds of the world if you're doing Vajrasattva, or so forth and so forth and so forth, right? So you would manifest an ideal and practice being it. That's called arising yoga. You all know that, don't you? Or if you don't, now you do. Of course. And any of you not going to answer no matter what I say?
Yes.
I have a show of hands on that one, please. I just like to know these things, you know how it is. So this is a quote from Lama Yeshe. The reason you see yourself as a deity is to transcend mundane appearances and mundane actions. Actually, seeing yourself as a deity has nothing to do with Tibetan culture. When you project your usual self-pitying image, you think you are not involved with a culture, but you are. Instead, transform yourself into a blissful, radiant light and cultivate strong divine pride. Is that lovely? Mm. I think that's one of the best descriptions I've heard of arising yoga. Mm. So what it's pointing at is this really wonderful, and this is Amitabha Buddha, who is the Buddha a family that represents the power of perception. Perception is always linked to the passion. If you have a certain type of passion, then the perception will match that. If you know that life sucks, when you walk outside, a pigeon will shit on you. Is that basically true? Mm-hmm. If you know that life is wonderful, the same pigeon will shit on you and you'll think, oh, that must be some kind of blessing. Isn't that true? Yes. Or figure out how you're going to make a joke of it and make everybody happy. True? Mm-hmm. But if you're in a bad mood, oh, I'm going to go back and kill myself. Or somebody else. Or as wherever there is a passion, there is a perception. Where there is a perception, there's a passion. They're linked. They're always linked. And habitually, they are running. I have a dear friend whose name I won't mention other than she's called Charlene. And and probably none of you know her, so I won't mention her name. But I knew her family quite well at one time. I was very involved with a lot of her family at one time.
Related, as it were.
But we won't have to go there either. And I knew her mother very, very well. Her mother and I shared certain things, like a birth sign. And her mama was a housekeeper. But when she was keeping house, she would get into this quiet rage. You know the kind of thing I mean? Mm-hmm. Where when the person is dusting and you wonder whether you should go to the storm cellar or something. You know that one? You've seen people do that? Yeah, there is this like quality. They're coming with the mop and before they're even there, you're like... you stop breathing in case that might be the wrong thing to do. You know the kind? And she was a cleaner. So my friend, whose name I haven't mentioned, of course, and I would be sitting around having tea because I was seducing her with poetry books, which is one of my favorite things to do to people, especially those who think they don't like poetry. And at that time, she thought she didn't like reading other people's poetry. So, you know me. Oh, well, have I got T.S. Eliot for you? So I'm sitting there, I go over and I've got a bag full of books and we're having tea and I keep pulling out poetry books and reading a little quote to her and then sticking them back and then pretty soon she says, who wrote that, you know? And we're having this wonderful time having tea and she looks at the watch and she realizes that it's late, she's got to get dinner ready, right? And she jumps up and from just having this really wonderful time together where she's like getting into poetry and I'm, you know, and learning how to like it and we're drinking tea and everything's wonderful and then as soon as she stands up she immediately starts, there's this like little rage thing, like she's cleaning now because from her mother, oh, now when you're cleaning you have to bang everything together, like the perception is, oh, now I gotta clean the table, and immediately the passion for cleaning, whatever it was you learned, takes over. Oh, now I've got to be in a family. Immediately the passions you learned about a family take over. We all know that. Sometimes it takes us two or three relationships before we go, oh, wait a minute. Is there something familiar about this pattern? And we start becoming conscious of our perceptions and start thinking, well, maybe I want to change that a little bit. Maybe I want to watch how I'm wanting something, or watch, maybe I don't want that. Maybe just because it feels familiar doesn't mean that I want to do it. Is that true? Mm-hmm. So, at first there are the passions and there are the perceptions. And then after a while you get so that you know that basically the passion is without a fixed identity. Is that true? The passion is just a wind, and if I get up and I start thinking I'm going to clean the house and anger comes up, I can just watch that and choose not to use it as anger. Is that true?
Yes.
So I can know that I can just see the passion as coming into being and passing away, but not fixed in any way. Right?
Yes.
And I also know that the perception is very, very changeable.
Yeah.
The perception is based on the perceiver. Right? Mm-hmm. Some of you have siblings, do you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How many of you have siblings? Okay, those of you who don't, maybe you've had some other kind of partners in your life. I don't know, it's possible. And when you have a sibling, do you and your sibling always agree on something that happened last week or last month or last year? Or when you're talking about the same event, do you have the same experience?
No.
But you're at the same place?
Did we come from the same family?
Yeah. So there are different perceptions, even when you're the same race, you know, in the same family. But imagine a dog and a human. What would their perception of the same event be with slightly different senses? Yeah. Like totally different again, right? Mm-hmm. And you also know, other than the siblings, that everybody is right. I mean, present siblings accepted. But you know that everybody is, in fact, from their point of view, people are always right.
Yes.
There is always a cause for how they're seeing. Maybe you don't agree with the cause, but that doesn't mean that it isn't to them something that they're choosing to do. That's a cause in their own being, right? So perceptions arise dependent on cause and effect. And they can change like that, can't they? Mm-hmm. You can think you see one thing and then the light shifts and you say, oh no, that's not it. Or mirages. Or a person you think you know and then they turn around and it's not them. Is that true?
Yes.
So like the perception is more like a kind of a clarity, like a movie screen on which all the images condense. And you put them together, you put the meaning of it together by your mind, by what you assume the passion brings up, certain memories that fit that pattern. And you say, oh, that's that. Oh, that's an eggplant. Oh, that's an orange. But maybe it's an eggplant that had a little problem in the garden and turned orange. And it's a funny shape. Is that true? So like when I was in Todd Ness, my dear friend Ross gave this to me, which I just thought was brilliant. It was in the paper. Isn't that great? Passion and perception. Isn't that just beautiful? But for most of us, did you find it? Oh, thank you. For most of us, most of the time, we don't know that's true. We don't know that the passion is based on past conditioning and the perception is when that passion comes up, seeing what is present and then your mind going through the catalog of what it could be and coming up with a suitable name that suits your own cause and effect. Mm-hmm. We don't know that's not true because it fits the meaning we call ourself. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Anybody not get that one? Have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints there?
So how does the world manage to continue when everybody's kind of in their own little created world? How do people do things together and what's really going on?
Well, it's not a problem doing things together. It's a problem because, you know, there are certain passions that we all share. Fear, desire for happiness, desire for safety. They're basically called the eight worldly dharmas. Do you remember the eight worldly dharmas? Do you remember me talking about it last time?
I remember you talking about it, but I don't remember.
Yeah. Should I just ask everybody to tell me what they are? I like doing that. You know I like doing that.
Praise.
You know, I, yeah.
Praise is mine.
Yeah.
Gain and loss.
Gain and loss.
Like, well, like and dislike.
Yeah, it's close. Mm-hmm. It's not quite like and dislike.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Pleasure
and dissatisfaction. And like,
yes.
Basically pleasure and dissatisfactory.
Yes.
Fame and obscurity. Yeah. So what did you say the first one was? Gain?
Praise and blame.
Oh yeah, praise and blame. Which is the fire energy. Which is Amitabha, the fire energy. That is to say, you love to be loved, and it's really a drag when somebody dubs you. And you're continuously trying to make sure that everybody loves you, or that you get the orgasm, or whatever it is, the best chocolate, the best cookie, whatever. Right?
Wow.
And when somebody doesn't, kind of, somebody else gets the best, there's like a sense of mortal woundedness, or somebody doesn't understand you, or somebody doesn't take you seriously, it's like mortally wounded, right? So it was the second one, gain and loss, right? Gain and loss, that's like, you are your possessions, you are your position. And if you lose your job, you lose your identity. It happens to a lot of people when they retire, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's terrifying. True?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one? Happiness and dissatisfactoriness. It's like that quality of happiness, not happy, but when you're not bothered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you can just glide along in neutral and nobody notices? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when everything is comfortable, you feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're sitting on a nice seat on, what? How many of you ever take a bus? Do any of you take a bus? Okay, you're sitting on a nice seat in a bus and everything's comfortable, and then suddenly somebody runs into the bus and the person next to you bangs you and you have to get off the bus. So like when you're sitting on the bus because you've sat there day after day after day, you know where you are, everything's fine, you've kind of gone into a half dream world because you know you'll sort of surface when it comes near your bus stop. Does that make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that is what they're talking about, happiness. It means sort of like almost asleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in your own understanding that this is what I know what I'm doing and everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then when something interrupts that, there's like this sense of anger or dissatisfaction or
mm-hmm.
something's
yeah.
wrong.
Because right.
I am this state of like that, and then boom! Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the last one?
An element.
Oh, what element is that? That's water.
Water. Okay. And the last one is
fame and obscurity.
Exactly. So fame has more to, not so much to do with fame as it has to do with control. Feeling like, okay, I may not be lovable, but I got power.
Madonna?
I don't know her. I've never met her. So, but that kind of quality of I like to know what's happening, where everybody is, and, you know, what are you doing there, and what are you doing there, and that kind of quality of that, you know? And the feeling of fear if somebody knows something that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
Some of you are. Yeah.
Yes.
So that would be the last one, and that's air element.
Mm.
So what was the Okay, gain and loss was what element?
Earth.
Why are they associated with elements like that?
Could I come back to that question?
Sure.
Do you mind just holding it?
Not even be important.
I just want to say this isn't the book.
This isn't exactly it. I can't find the book. Book's lost. No, it's a red covered book. I just don't know where it is.
I want, because I think you've got the wrong mantra in here for the you've got a mantra for dependent arising, which is not in that. I don't believe.
No, it isn't. That's right.
That's all I wanted to check.
Oh, we don't have the translation for that. We had something from another Tara text, white Tara text, and I just transferred it in until we find the exact right one. We have one from another one.
Maybe.
She dared to.
Okay. I think I know.
Because it wasn't actually in the text that we were using, so I got it from something else.
We'll see if it's in here. Excuse me for a moment, because this is what I want to do tonight, actually, is go through that. Through a sadhana and there it is. Om Yidharma Hetu Prabhu Hetu Teshan Tatagata Hivadata Teshan Chayo Nirodho Iwam Wadi Maha Shamana Yeswaha.
Thank you, we need that. Thank you.
All of dharmas which have a cause, the Tathagata has proclaim the cause and their cessation, the truth-telling great ascetic, swaha. And there is actually a difference between this and the other mantra.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's on page 94 here.
Thank you.
Where was I? Oh, gosh, I was going on and on, sorry, about
perception.
Arising yoga and perception and passion. And I just wanted to catch you up on the fact that the most profound thing about changing your passions and changing your perceptions is habit.
Yes.
That how you change your passions and change your perception is by habit, no other way. Because when it becomes familiar, you automatically will go to that. And because the habit of the wholesome is more enjoyable than the habit of the unwholesome, you will go to the habit that brings you the greatest pleasure. This is why it's said that all beings can awaken, because we all love to be habituated and we all love pleasure. So if you learn that you can change your perception and passion habits to something that works more for your favor, and not only your favor, but for the benefit of all beings, you will start doing it. Just like Alexander technique, isn't it? Once you do it a few times, it feels better, so you do it. But you do have to do it a few times. And when you're doing it a few times, there will be one part of your brain that won't be able to acknowledge that anything has changed. That's called pride. And because there is a sense that I am this, and not the ability to see the changes in your being all day, the subtle little changes all the time. You just negate them. You see yourself as a solid, unflinching cannonball in life. But it's not true. It's not true at all. There are like continuous little changes, but the mind doesn't let the picture of the self change. Or doesn't let oneself become aware of the changing of the picture. Is that pretty straightforward? You all know that stuff, don't you? So when you're doing an arising yoga tantra, arising yoga practice, two things are profoundly interesting to me. One is that you're practicing consciously being aware of changing your mind. Mm-hmm. And the other is that you actually start to feel slightly different when you perform this, just while you're doing this performance. And you actually develop the awareness that you can just subtly change your passions and your perceptions. So you get a lot of faith develops from doing these practices. Faith in the Buddhist way, faith meaning confidence. Mm-hmm. Confidence. Confidence in yourself and confidence in the next step. Which is very beautiful, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints so far?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask what divine pride is.
Divine pride is the pride of having compassion, being deity of compassion, deity of equanimity, deity of whatever practice.
How is it different than pride? Pride was fixed view and then divine pride.
Mostly because the passion that there is, the pride attached to, is not self-grasping. And other types of pride are basically this self-hunger. Mm-hmm. And it's really hunger. It's like you have the time, you don't even know how much you're grabbing for something. Mm-hmm. And that maybe everybody mm-hmm. wants it as much as you do. Because mm-hmm. it's just your awareness of your grab that rules you when you're doing that. Just like all of the attitudes that create suffering, most of the time we don't even realize that what we're doing is like self-grasping. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. it just feels normal to us. It's not until we start getting the results that we start to say, why is this happening to me? And for, you know, if you're like me for a long time, you say, oh, it's just because nobody understands me. But eventually, maybe you get bored with that. Certainly your friends get bored very quickly. And maybe you say, yeah, but what is it that I'm doing that nobody understands? And what would they understand? And who are they? Whoa! Then life gets much more interesting mm-hmm. when it's populated with other people.
Would that be the same? Because I wonder, we practice bodhisattva, we practice a lot of different deities, which are ideals, in a way. And yet, when we look at the difficulties that we encounter, we're also dealing with ideals, hidden ideals. So I'm wondering if it's the same type of thing.
If your practice is only about ideals, then yes, I would have to say you're doing the same practice whether your legs are crossed or not. But if your practice is actually wondering whether that's possible, mm. then it's not an ideal anymore. It's like a question.
Okay.
And from my point of view, the very best meditation practice is when you have interest. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you don't already know.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people I know, when we start meditating, we think we know what we're supposed to do, mm-hmm. even though we're just starting. Mm-hmm. We have this idea that we know what we should be doing when we meditate, and of course it isn't what we are doing. But to actually not know when you're on the cushion is probably the most profound thing you can do. So that's not an ideal, it's an exploration. Unless it's an ideal exploration. I don't think I should have said that. Oops. So, any other questions answered? Is that okay now if I plunge into this and we look at what a sadhana then is? Because this is one that sadhana, as I told you last time, comes from the root word sadha, S-A-D-H-A, which means in Buddhism, it's usually translated as faith. Good. You want to hand them out? Does everybody have a pen? Because there's a few things I'm going to change.
Great.
Three more pens. Anybody need one?
No more sadhanas.
No more sadhanas?
I can share this. It's going to the same house. Karen, are you sharing?
I don't need one.
She's beyond all that.
I have one.
But you do want to look at it because you didn't.
Sure. Okay.
So this is White Tara, the practice of White Tara, which is this deity behind me, only she's gold here, because she's as good as gold in this picture. But if you weren't looking at her through gold-colored glasses, you'd see she was actually white. This one here. And she has these eyeballs everywhere. One on each foot, one on each hand, and three on her face. So when you're doing an arising yoga tantra, for example, because what you're going to do is you're going to dissolve your habitual way of using your passions and perceptions and try to imagine yourself using your passion a different way. You can think of the passions of your being, whether they're dullness, boredom, joy, exuberance, you know, whatever they are, jealousy, fear, hatred, whatever they are, they're called winds in their crudest form. They're called winds in their most subtle form. They're called winds. But quite often when you read texts of Tibetan Buddhism, they use the word winds more for this more subtle form of them. Mm-hmm. But really in all the forms of the emotions, the whole speech body is the winds. Body, body, speech body, mind body. So the whole saying that you've heard me repeat ad nauseum, and I'll do one more time. Maybe we'll do it as a chorus, shall we? Consciousness, which has no legs, rise winds, which have no eyes. Once more. Consciousness, which has no legs, rise winds which have no eyes. Last time. Consciousness which has no legs, rise winds which have no eyes. That's very important. Very important to know that. The winds are just dancing. When you go through the understanding of the 16 stages of emptiness, one of the emptiness stages is understanding that the winds are not self. Anger is not self. Greed is not self. They're winds. Mm-hmm. And the winds are going to be, they have the power of the movement, the legs. And they're going to be moving. If you're dragged by them, you're not using your eyes. Either the winds are going to drag you or you're going to ride them. That's what that says. Is that clear? So when you understand that, there is a point where you can start taking any wind, regardless, and have it move you where you want it to go, where you want to go. But the first stage is to realize that you can sit there and then practice feeling neutral and then arise in your being as a wind that is some deity, like this. And whether you believe it or not, you pretend you do. Mm-hmm. And you do that for like 2 or 3 months, and then you see whether your friends notice anything different about you. You won't notice. But your friends might suddenly start thinking you're just a little nicer. Just a touch, you know. A little less critical, a little more punctual, whatever. Whatever. It's so curious how if you do a practice, your friends get so much nicer. I always find it quite interesting. One of my favorite things about meditation. So in order to do this meditation, you sit upon a comfortable meditation seat and begin the session by taking refuge. You see that right there, right? You're going to do three things. Take refuge, generate the Bodhi mind, and meditate on the four immeasurable thoughts. So if you're going to take refuge, you can say this classical refuge. If you're not sure whether you're a Buddhist or not, you don't have to say it. What you do is what we were saying the other day, you remember firsts. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was talking about. Mm-hmm. Remember the first time you had an experience with a teacher in high school or something, or 1 minute you didn't understand something and then suddenly the next minute you got it? Mm-hmm. Or you learned how to, scramble eggs, 1 minute you didn't understand how to do it, mm-hmm. the next minute you got it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Oh, you learned how to listen to the tea kettle boil so that you could hear when it sounded like wind through bamboo. 1 minute you didn't get it, the next minute you got it. Right? That moment between not knowing something and suddenly understanding something is the same energy as guru. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's the value of guru, isn't it? That moment of being open to a new understanding. That's what you have devotion for, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If you really look at it. Mm-hmm. So if you don't like the word guru because you feel picky that day or whatever, or Buddha or whatever, you allow yourself to recall whatever it is that brings that mind state of remembering what I call firsts. Mm-hmm. That you do know how your mind can open to a new understanding. Yeah. So you can say, in the Buddha, his teaching, in the excellent community, if that brings you that sense of the beauty of that, if you have a sense of the joy of Dharma, then of course you would say that. You know, if you had a Dharma teacher for the last 50 lifetimes, every time they walked in the room, they swatted everybody and spat on them, maybe you wouldn't want to say that. Maybe when you said the Buddha is teaching, you go into a fear state, you know, and shit your pants or something. So you don't want to say that then. Because it's not preparing you, is it? Do you understand what I'm saying here? Like how you start is very important. You start by remembering that you love to see something new. You love it in the spring when you smell the lilacs for the first time. It's like wonderful. True?
Yeah.
So that's what you go for. And the excellent community, isn't that true? Those moments when you feel community, when do you ever lose them? When you have a moment with someone, a friendship with someone, a quality of understanding with someone, when do you ever lose that? Only if you forget to recall it.
Mm-hmm.
It's as fresh in your heart 10, 20, 30 years later as it is the moment it happened, isn't it? That's community, right? That's a refuge. Because again, it's like, again, opening beyond self. Number one rule in Dharma, self-grasping sucks. Number one rule in Dharma, if you want to be free of suffering, you have to be able to dissolve the fear that holds you separate. True?
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? Well, joy's always good, eh? A little joy, you know, a few bad jokes, that's nice. I take refuge in the Buddha, his teaching, and the excellent community. You can do it classically, but if you have problems with classical, use the principles. The principles are true of your humanity, not something out there. They are your highest ability, not something out there. I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. By the merit of generosity, I like the word power there, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm.
By the power of generosity.
Mm.
By the power of generosity and other good deeds. That's talking about either the 6 marks of Sila or the 10 marks of Sila, whichever way you want to say. And those are powers. Those are powers. The power of generosity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And other good deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. Good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that 3 times. And then you say, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. What is that?
Metta,
loving kindness. What is metta? What is loving kindness?
Wishing people well.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Friendliness.
From
the heart.
Okay. But did you know that when the Visuddhimagga says that when loving kindness is fully developed, it becomes a state of being boundless beauty?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a nice place to live.
Yeah.
Hmm. Boundless beauty. When the heart is practicing kindness, you live in boundless beauty. So that's called, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
May all beings be apart from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. What's that?
Compassion.
Compassion. Why is it compassion? Same reason why. Why is loving kindness loving kindness? Why is this one compassion? Because when compassion is fully developed, it becomes boundless spaciousness,
mm-hmm.
not boundless cottonousness.
Mm-hmm.
Be apart from sorrow and the causes of sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
How do you develop loving kindness? By looking at first yourself and wishing yourself to be well and happy. Looking at people you love and wishing them to be not lust, but love. Wishing them to be well and happy. Going with what you already like and thinking, may it continue to have a wonderful life, right? And then you extend it slowly through the people that are you sort of neutral about. And the people who have the, you know, the bad taste to dislike you or cause you problems and so forth until you can just spread it out to all beings everywhere, right? So it becomes like how to be aware of the beauty in everything. True? Mm-hmm. When you develop compassion, how do you do that?
You know the sorrow, you live the sorrow, you're aware of the sorrow of suffering, thus you can translate that sorrow into a sharing of that experience and a letting go of it in that at the same time.
Yeah, especially the letting go part. That's where the accent is, because when you're practicing the meditation on compassion, you remember loving kindness first. Mm-hmm. And then you recall something that bugged you slightly within the last 3 years, like when you lost your car keys and you almost got somewhere and damn it. And you really recall it when it bugged the heaven out of you. You're racing around looking for them in all your pockets and really they're in the car or on the floor. And you're going nuts and I've got it. And you remember how tight you were because you had this appointment that, you know, the world would end if you didn't get to and blah, 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 blah. And then you fast forward to 3 weeks later when it wasn't a problem anymore. You totally forgot it. And you feel, what's it like when it's a problem? And there's this... And then you fast forward, what's it like when it wasn't a problem? There's this... And you go back and forth and back and forth between those two memories. Until you're really clear, this is what it's like when there is suffering. This is like what it's like where there's freedom of suffering. Then you go back to when it's suffering and you see if that space is actually gone or you're just focusing on the problem. And when you explore that, you find that the spaciousness is always there. Mm-hmm. But it's the focus that changes. Mm-hmm. And so that you teach yourself how to be present then in that, feeling the problem, but aware of the spaciousness in which it's arising. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm. And thus with another person when you're...
First you start it with yourself. Yes. With something that was a minor problem in the past, then you take it to something that's a minor problem in the present, mm-hmm. and you fast forward to the future, to when it would be finished. You know, I ate too much. Oh, in a couple of hours it won't be a problem. You know, whatever it is. You go back and forth until you're in your present now, you can feel that, and you can feel the spaciousness both. You do the same thing. Feel the problem, feel the fact that it's impermanent. Back and forth until you have a visceral sense of the spaciousness. And then you go back to the problem and you feel a visceral sense of that spaciousness with the visceral sense of the problem. So now you are aware of the suffering. You're not trying to change it or make, oh, never mind, everything will be all right, anything. But you're also aware of it arising in space, which is what we lose, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And then you go to something that somebody you know who you're quite neutral about has as a problem. A neutral person first. A small problem that they have in the present. And you imagine that in the future not being a problem. And you practice being aware of that problem. And then you go to a bigger one in the past and a bigger one for yourself in the present. And then a bigger one for a neutral person. And then when you, the final one you do is like somebody who you actually feel protective of, like a child or something. Some big problem they have, because that's the hardest one to do for compassion. What you're doing is you're developing the awareness of the spaciousness that's always present, regardless of the suffering. Mm-hmm. And you know most of the suffering is because you get caught up in such a tight knot.
Right.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah,
for sure. So yeah, it's sharing the suffering because you know it's impermanent. But a little more accent on the impermanent, a little more accent on the spaciousness. Mm-hmm. So compassion, when it's fully developed, becomes boundless spaciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
In a sense, is spaciousness letting go the same as generosity?
Well, certainly generosity is spacious, isn't it? I wouldn't be surprised if they have a lot in common. Yeah, I wouldn't at all. That makes sense to me. I haven't heard them described together. I'm just saying, like, you know, why not?
So I was thinking compassion and generosity.
They're probably both fruits, you know, like one would be an orange and one would be a pear, but they're both fruits.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That's great. That's good. I don't know. Just kidding.
Yes.
What about the practice, like we've been doing with you, and you know, where you see the gold light and you extend that in space to all in all directions? And does that help work with the development of compassion as well, or is that more?
It is, but it's mostly called sharing of merit. It's like imaging the wholesomeness and just imagine it sharing with all beings and easing suffering in the world.
Yeah.
So it's really like. Yeah. Manifesting a wish, changing, taking this energy that we have together and using it for the benefit of all beings.
And if you were just to, if you take that practice, you're extending in, you know, sometimes they do it with in space, just extending the consciousness in space and
yeah.
expanding and then. That practice of is that also develop compassion, or is it specifically like you're saying where you
any meditation on spaciousness can develop compassion.
Yeah.
But compassion is, like I said, linked to the element water. Did I say that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the eight worlds.
Yeah. And basically. What happens with it is there's a reflective power where we can feel quite comfortable, or we can get really angry.
Yeah.
Or feel like we're being threatened or something.
Yeah.
And what you want to do is in the state where whatever it is, whether you're in the comfortable part or the angry part, you're aware of the space in which it's operating. Because loving kindness and compassion, as you know with Chenrezig,
yeah.
Right there, that's Chenrezig there, above Richard's head. You know, one hand is doing loving kindness, one hand is doing compassion. And where are they acting? They're acting in the world. And the other hand is doing sympathetic joy, and the other one's doing equanimity, and they're doing the heart of the mind of the heart. So like, in the world, you're acting with loving kindness and compassion. And in your prayers for all beings, in your aspiration, sympathetic joy and equanimity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that applied to what you were asking, but I threw
it
there
anyway. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't realize it would take so long, but you know how gabby I am to get through this, but... Yeah, I think we might have to do two classes on this sadhana. I imagined us just whipping through it, but I don't think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, so may all never be separate from the sacred happiness that is sorrowless. What does that mean?
Sympathetic joy.
And? Mm-hmm. How do you develop? What is it? What is the defining characteristic of sympathetic joy? The Sudhi Magga is really good reading material. Really excellent. I highly recommend it. Any idea? I'll give you a hint, she said, reaching for her poetry books. This is called Love Poems from God. You know about St. John of the Cross? You know St. John of the Cross?
Yes.
You know much about his story?
No.
1957, as a result of the attempted reform of the Carmelite order and his alliance with Saint Teresa, he was kidnapped and imprisoned at Toledo. It was during this period of debased confinement and torture by his fellow priests that he miraculously composed some of his greatest poetry. For much of the 9 months St. John was in prison, he was confined to a tiny cell, actually an unlit closet, in which he could not even stand up. He was left to relieve himself on the floor of this tiny cell, and his few scraps of food and water were sometimes thrown into his feces and urine. On a regular basis, he was brought from his cell and beaten by some of the other priests, to the extent that he became permanently crippled. He was not given a change of clothes or allowed to wash for months. He became infested with lice and developed acute dysentery. He was forced to sleep upon his own excrement. The prison was in the basement of a monastery. One night in prayer, asking God for the strength to endure his confinement and torture, St. John had this remarkable experience or vision. He heard a duet in which God and he were the singers. I am dying of love, darling, what should I do? And the beloved responded, then die, my sweetheart, just die. Die to all that is not us. What could be more beautiful? I'm going to read it again. I am dying of love, darling, what should I do? And the beloved responded, then die, my sweetheart, just die. Die to all that is not us. What could be more beautiful? Sympathetic joy, when it's fully developed, is boundless consciousness. Let me read that poem one more time. I am dying of love, darling, what should I do? And the beloved responded, then die, my sweetheart, just die. Die to all that is not us. What could be more beautiful? Yeah. So it's an inner work, aspiration, with fulfillment. It's fire. How to use your passion, passion without object. The great dancer, Vajrayogini. Cut off the objects. And be passion, sympathetic joy, and everything you see is God, if you use those terms. But it could take a little while to get there. There's a few poems in here that do it, but I thought that one would be a quickie. Is that good?
Yes, thank you.
And the last one, setting aside attachment and aversion, may all beings dwell in equanimity. So that's what?
Boundless wisdom.
It's actually equanimity.
It's equanimity, but what's the boundless part?
Okay, the boundless part is not even boundless. It's just called, and it's not boundless, which is damn tricky, isn't it? I mean, three are saying boundless, duh, duh, duh. And this one says, no thingness.
No thingness.
Like Buckminster Fuller saying, God is a verb. No thingness. If everything is emotion, not an object, how can there be attachment and aversion? We don't get attached to rainbows, do we? Not really. we absolutely fall in love with them, and it's the way they fade is even beautiful. Because a rainbow is a verb. You know that. Don't you know that? We all know that. But you're a verb, and she, you know, we're all verbs. My hair is a verb. Oh my God, I never thought. Your glasses are a verb. Your underwear is a verb. Your partner is a verb. Everything is a verb. The floor is a verb.
It's flooring.
It's flooring. Is that clear? Is that good? Yeah. Kind of fun? So that's what the four Brahma Viharas actually are talking about. They're talking about your aspiration that you use earth, loving kindness, water, compassion, fire, sympathetic joy, and air, equanimity, the winds that the consciousness is riding, for the benefit, for the clarity of seeing the reality, not being caught in subject-object duality. Which is kind of nice, isn't it? It's a nice little prayer. Oh, by the way, I would like for the ultimate benefit of all beings, now this is called the Bodhisattva vow. For the ultimate benefit of all beings, I must myself accomplish the state of Buddhahood. For this reason, I now enter into this meditation and mantra recitation upon the holy white Tara. The wish-fulfilling wheel by which immortality is attained. Now, who knew white Tara would grant immortality? But that's what she's on about. And it's true, she is actually on about immortality. Why? Because she is the unborn. So therefore, the undying. It's beautiful, isn't it? Not sure? That's okay, we'll go further. Meditate in this way, generate a firm confidence that the meditational practice, and mantra recitation, which is about to be performed, has the ability to accomplish all temporary and ultimate purposes, even the state of perfect Buddhahood. Now perform the hollow body visualization. And you say, Om Sobhava Shuddha Sarvadharma Sobhava Shuddha Hum. Actually, Namjo Rinpoche is the only teacher I know who says that three times. Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is.
And also, you know, the Chenrezi that is in body, speech, and mind that a lot of people do a lot of the time? Tarchin did a few adaptations on it, and Mark Weber did too, a few little bit, basically. And did you know that's a Sakya practice?
No. Not that.
I'm sorry. Are you all right, you smell? Because I decided, you know, there's this group of people in Edmonton, they call me their resident teacher, so every once in a while I flex my muscles, and I think it's nice for them to practice other... Okay, you've been doing this Chenrezi for a very long time. There are other Chenrezis. Okay, let's do a Kagyu one now. So I have a tape. I got Isaac Sakari to tape the one that Kala Rinpoche does. Because I used to have a tape of Kala Rinpoche, but it's burnt toast now. And so I got Zach to tape the one that Kala Rinpoche did. And you notice that Kala Rinpoche is what? And Alec... I mean, and Zach was a car Jew. Oh, that was, that's, yeah. No, Now, just a minute. That, now, wait a minute. No, no. That's Zach's pun. Zach's background is he's Jewish.
Yes.
And Kargyu is one of the was four schools of Tibetan Buddhists, so I used to call himself a Kargyu. Bad story. I'll try not to explain it again. And that was Zach's. That was Zach's. And that's not me. That's him.
Okay,
but anyway, he's a great chanter. He's a wonderful singer, yeah.
So, do you mean that that translation that Sonam did in the really early 70s, coming from Kalu Rinpoche, is the Kargyu version of the White Tara?
I don't know. You'd have to show me which one, because Sonam did most of the translations.
Right.
And then he handed them to me, and I wrote them up, like, and typed them, and passed them out most of the time. So you'd have to show me which one. But Sonam spent a lot of time when Brenda was also in India mm-hmm. with Sakya Trinsing getting a lot of texts and initiations. And a lot of those are what we did in New Zealand mm-hmm. and then continue to do after mm-hmm. that and are what most of you received from Dharma Center. But anyway, the Chenrezig that's in the back of Bhagavad Speech Mind is actually Sakya tradition. And so I decided that it would be nice for people in Edmonton to do a Kargyu mm-hmm. translation. And I got the tape from Zach, and I got the text that I made nice texts up, and I gave them, took them up to Edmonton all happy. And I was going away, so I thought it would be nice for them to explore it, chanting with the tape and, you know, learning to ring their bells at different times and stuff. You know, it's always nice to do. And like over half of them quit doing it because they weren't going to do the wrong Chenrezig. And that was exactly, and some of those people actually dropped out of the group because it was the wrong Chenrezig. I'm just saying that you will meet things that you are assuming are something. You say, Om Sabhava Shuddha Sarvadharma three times. Well, maybe you do and maybe you don't. Don't ever forget to wonder. Mm-hmm. You know, meditation is not doing it right. It's having your mind open. Because if you're sitting there and you're going to do the right meditation, how do you know anything? Where is it you're going to find out whether that meditation actually is something that actually has some reason for you or some power for you? Or are you just putting on more makeup? Am I perfectly clear about this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We keep trying to make life fit us.
Yeah.
Hey, I got news. Life is going to fit us so well, we're going to be dead. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is, if we're not making life fit us, is there anything? That's what we want to know. Mm-hmm. So every time you think you're doing the right Chenrezig, change it. Is that clear?
Oh, yes.
So I just thought I'd mention that about three times here.
Okay, thanks, Sess.
You're welcome. with the state of purity of all Dharma, so also here. Om Sabhava Shuddha Sarvadharma. Shuddha is purity. Like Visuddha, Visuddhi Magga. Have I said that word before, didn't I? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You might have mentioned it sometime.
You said it was really
such
great.
A delicious.
It has that rolls around. Another sip, maybe.
Rolls-Royce.
Mm-hmm. Kind of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Within the, and so then you image the spaciousness of your being. Image that you're actually, you're just an inner tube and all that stuff that I talk about all the time, you know, a bunch of bubbles. Within the sphere of emptiness, a lotus bearing a moon cushion. the sound Tara resonates. And instantly, I appear seated upon the lotus as the venerable white Tara. My legs are folded into the full Vajra posture. My right hand is in the mudra of supreme generosity. See, that's what she's doing here. She's giving nothing. She's no thinging. There's no thinging. She's just no thinging at the yin yang. It's amazing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Just everything becomes a verb. And more. Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
My legs are folded into the full Vajra posture. My right hand is in the mudra of supreme generosity. My left hand, which is poised at my heart, holds the stem of a lotus that opens into blooms beside my left shoulder. And it has a bloom, a bud, and what's the third one?
Fruit.
A fruit, sort of.
Yeah.
So representing the Buddha's, or the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha mind of the past, present, and future, mm-hmm. basically. Some people say it, instead of it being that, they have it as an Utpala flower. Mm-hmm. Utpala, they just have one sometimes. Utpala is a mythical lotus that when the myth of the Utpala is that when the Utpala lotus opens, all other lotuses close. Because the ordinary lotus represents relative bodhicitta, coming from the mud, moving through the murky water, eventually transcending and opening for the benefit of all beings. The Utpala represents absolute bodhicitta, the attainment. Mm. So when it opens, the other one closes, all the others close. They're like, so in this case, it's talking about that absolute bodhicitta in time.
And it's good past, present, and future. Mm.
Sitting upright on a moon disc, a moon is my backrest, precious ornaments adorn my 16-year-old bod, and Amitabha Buddha sits upon my head as a crown. Amitabha is a Buddha perception. The white syllable Om marks my forehead, the red syllable Ah marks my throat, the blue syllable Hum, my heart, representing body, speech, and mind. But transforming these into three kayas of the enlightened ones. Any questions on that? Of course, I expect you to ask them. Kayas means formations or bodies, three bodies. So in this case, it would be the Nirmana Kaya. I like that if you took it literally, it would be Nirm is not, Mana, mind, not mind, not the mind body. Oh, that must be the body body. Well, it's not the mind body. Ramsha used to like that one, right? What's mind? No matter. What's matter? Never mind. That one all the time. Remember that? What's mind? No matter. What's matter? Never mind. That's where I learned all my bad jokes from my beloved teacher. Mm-hmm. Before I met him, I was very serious and quiet.
And you're still quiet.
That I get away with that.
Who believes that?
What was that picture I saw on the cover of the Telegram?
Would you just really shut up? I'm talking about a sudana. A sadhana.
Okay. A sudana?
A sudana.
Sounds good.
Why? I don't bring up those kind of memories with you, you know. I mean, I could.
Go ahead.
Because I'd be there too, I can't.
Why Why is there a moon everywhere?
Because moon also represents a relative bodhicitta.
Why? Why is this?
Because it's in time.
Okay.
So the sun represents absolute bodhicitta. The moon goes through different phases. The moon. There are a lot of reasons, but for the moment, can we just leave it as relative? Is that okay?
That's fine.
We only got 10 minutes left, so.
Okay.
And we have a long way to go. This is definitely going to be 2 classes.
And then you're going to give another class?
Sunday morning.
That was a lovely suggestion.
I'm busy tomorrow.
Yeah, so many of us are busy.
Oh. Precious ornaments adorn my 16-year-old body. Amitabha Buddha sits on my head as a crown. The white syllable, marks, we did that, right? Transforming into the 3 kayas, Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya. Sorry, Carol. Temporary insanity.
Okay, so Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya,
and Dharmakaya,
which is the mind.
Yeah, it's called the body of truth, body of law. The syllable ah appears at my heart and transforms into a round moon disc. Bearing the white syllable tam, light emanates from the tam at my heart, inviting the wisdom beings from their natural abode. And basically, when you do that, what you're doing is you are saying, okay, I'm empty body, hollow body. Now I am going to name what I would like to manifest as. And this is what I would like to manifest of as. And then with my whole heart, I pray for this manifestation to be blessed. So that's what you're doing here. You said, okay, this is who I want to be. And then you're asking, would you kindly pour it into me? With this line here. Is that interesting to you?
Yes.
Light emanates from the tam at my heart, inviting the wisdom beings from their natural abode. So this first manifestation of Tara is the one that you are doing, kind of like a container, and then you're asking the contained to enter it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking now the real wisdom that is white Tara in the universe to enter this.
Yeah.
And so you go, and the tam light goes out, and usually you would say the Om Vajra Samaja, which is like, Om, you guys, please come here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Om Vajra Samaja. You do that?
Mm-hmm.
You bring it toward you. And when you're sending something away from you, you go this way. But in this case, you're bringing it towards you. And if you actually were doing this, you would say, Om Vajra Samaja. Ja, which is what? A hook. What is a hook? Loving kindness. Ja. A noose. See? I could hang myself. Ja. Home. See the noose? Look between where my head is going through the
noose. Oh. Got it.
Noose.
Yeah.
Compassion. Bam. Chain. Link. The link of a chain. Sympathetic joy. A profoundly powerful bond. Whole. Everything's blown to smithereens by the hammer hitting. It's all atoms dancing. No thingness. Equanimity. So you're saying by using Ja Hum Bam Ho. You're activating the elements. I'll do this over and over, so don't worry about it. Ja. Boom. Bum. Hope. You're activating the elements now. Before you were wishing for them. Now you're saying, I am in control of the universe. Ja. Hooking with loving kindness. Because that's how you hook things, isn't it? By liking them. Ha. Don't you like my bad jokes? Okay, I'll tell some good ones maybe. Tell me one first. Ja! Hook. Home. Don't worry about the fingers so much. What you want to do is get the noose. Yeah. Home. The fingers may or may not hook. Don't worry about that. Because what you're really doing is that's right, got the noose there. So it's a noose, it's a chain, you're lassoing. Is that actually from Alberta, this one? It's from the Stampede.
Uh-huh. You mean like yoga, like yoke, like that kind of a noose?
The noose of a rope where you're throwing a noose and, you know, hooking a cow, and you know, when we go out riding and cow.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Yeah. Ryan Rogers?
Dale Evans.
Rope? Noose. And the noose, you see the spaciousness, but the compassion. Mm-hmm. Bam, the chain of sympathetic joy. So that's the link of a chain, see? See, that's the link of a chain. You're just looking at the square part in there. It's the link of a chain, right? And the hammer is just your two wrists hitting each other. Oh. Blowing everything to smithereens. It's all just nothinging. Mm. Everything's just nothinging. Ja, hum, bum, hum. Now, some people do it slightly a little more like not so obvious. I'm showing you the most obvious way. This is actually what they are. Yeah, ja, hum, bum, hum. Like that. And it's basically saying, now, with the power to direct the four winds, I call you here. As you know, your basic magic is what you're doing. And then, now that they're here, but they're here, now you make offerings to them, vast offering bowls, cars from exquisite jewels are radiant offerings. In nature, these offerings are the wisdom of bliss and emptiness. In form, they are offerings. In function, they act as objects of the senses that evoke transcendental joy. Was that actually in the puja? That part? Yeah, I think it may have been too.
I think so.
But that's okay. It's not there. Then, Om Aryatara Sapariwara. So you're imagining, at this point, she's actually in front of you. So she hasn't become one with you. So actually the Ja Hum Bam Ho comes down here where it's written in the text. But now you know it when we get there tomorrow. You'll be able to do it like that. So at the moment you've invited the Samyatar and she's in front of you. The wisdom being. You've invited her and she's in front. The Jnana Tara. She's in front of you. And so she's in front of you and you say, oh, you're so welcome here and let me offer you. And from your heart come all these deities. So now they're going out, so you go like this. And then argyam, padyam, you know, the stuff. Water for drinking is the first one. Argyam is drinking water. Padyam, the feet, water for washing. Pudpe, flowers. Actually, flowers actually, yeah, energy fields, but it actually literally means, in the Tibetan, it literally means good qualities. Good qualities, like when you're in a happy state of mind, that's a good quality, and if you can feel it around, you know. And incense is moral conduct, yeah, so moral conduct. Wisdom is light. Perfume water is not the power of merit, it's the power of faith. Perfume water is faith, and it comes from the Indian tradition when you were waiting for a really beloved guest, somebody you really respected, you would get a bowl of perfumed water and you would be standing there at the door ready to massage their feet. Mm-hmm. So your hands would be ready and you'd have this perfumed water. You'd be waiting with anticipation, like the faith of waiting for the beloved to come. Mm-hmm. So most of these all come from India, right? Mm-hmm. So that's perfumed water, not merit. Mm-hmm. Food is not actually interdependence. It's like basically in this book, and I brought this book in case anybody wanted to see it in print. It's called The Holy Food of Meditation. The offerings which circle about the two waters and ocean of hearing. Because when you let go of the past, the desire for the future, and you let go of the dust of the past, water for drinking, cut down the thirst, water for washing the feet, let go of the dust of the past. Flowers, then you're actually present in the moment, so it's an ocean of hearing, mm-hmm. H-E-A-R-I-N-G. Mm-hmm. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. The two waters, an ocean of hearing. The flowers, good qualities, a cloud of incense, moral conduct, or the offering lamp's wisdom, an ocean of scented water, faith, meditative concentration, the noble food of ambrosia. Or some people just say meditation, the food. It's like what you're nourishing, or what is nourishing to your being, meditation. And then the sounds produced by symbols and songs of praise. Mm-hmm.
Praise.
Songs of praise. Mm. Okay. So that's enough for tonight. Mm. And tomorrow night, of course, we'll finish it.
That's great.
Is this useful?
Very useful, thank you.
Any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints? It's awfully hot in here, isn't it? Yes?
I just wondered, some teachers I've talked to, some traditions I've heard of, have a view that with sadhana practice, it is something that you do in relationship with a teacher, like you receive a transmission from a teacher who you have faith in, and that is how you practice, like rather as opposed to the idea of just going and getting one from a book or somewhere. And I mean, nowadays it's much easier to find sadhanas, you can get them on the internet. But
so yeah, one should receive the teaching from a teacher.
I'm talking more transmission or initiation, yeah. Whatever word you want to use, but that some teachers I've talked to, they give transmission to students with whom they have relationship or something, and that tantric way of practicing or in this way is, it's something done in that context, not just, like I said, maybe going and getting one from a book or, you know, reading it or whatever, like.
No, I don't think you would go and get one from a book, but I think that I have talked to a lot of Tibetan teachers about how they received a teaching or something. And many of them received many, many sadhanas, but most of the time they didn't understand the language that it was done in, because the language that we hear Tibetans saying when they're doing a chanting of a sadhana is not spoken Tibetan language. It's a special language that is only used. So a lot of the time they get this whole teaching, but they never get the practice on it, and they have to like really want to get the practice before they even get near a sadhana.
Yeah, right.
So you have to first of all understand that we are a very different culture than the Tibetan culture was. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of Tibetans rely on the feeling of the experience as the transmission.
Yes.
Not on the text at all. And that you would also maybe get the transmission from one teacher, and then it might be 20 years before you get the text from another teacher, and then it might be 5 years before you get the teaching from someone else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea that one teacher is like the only one, I think that's very much part of our kind of like, you know, possessive quality that we have about things in North America. Mm-hmm. You know, we do like possessions.
And patents.
And patents. It's true though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Don't we? And I can see the real value, like I was going to talk about that more tomorrow night. I see the real value in sticking to the texts that we receive and receiving sadhanas from people that have done the practice and have that ability to actually understand it.
Yeah.
I certainly agree with that. I don't think it's necessary to continue to study with the teacher that gives you the practice, because if so, I wouldn't be able to do half the meditations that I've done.
Yeah.
And you know what, that our beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche did, he bloody well died on us, you know. And who can you depend on? Like, those teachers, they disappear left, right, and center. Like, you know, they think they have rights. I mean, they just take off, don't they? I don't know. I mean, get as much teaching as you can, you know, like, do as much as you can with them, but, like, don't forget to look for another teacher at the same time if you need one.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you don't want your practice just to, you know... And is that what you were talking about?
No, not exactly.
Okay, what were you talking about?
I was just trying to say, could I go pick this up off the library and do it? Would that be...
I'm sorry that I wasn't clear.
So.
Well, thank you, Karen.
I asked a question, and yes, it didn't come out clearly.
Thank you. It's fine.
I was trying to understand the tradition of transmission, where versus just going off to a library or hearing. You know, I mean, if there is no tradition, I might be wrong. I just know of some teachers who.
You mean like right now when I am teaching this, and there are many people here who have not received this.
Well, maybe that's transmission.
Is that what I'm asking you? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm wondering about just picking up a practice because you feel like doing it, or if you hear it from a teacher, or this sort of transmit. Like you were saying, the Tibetans often had a teaching from a teacher. It might be a felt sense. They may not even understand the words.
I went through this for a long time, and then I finally decided that there were so many teachings available, and so many people were changing them slightly, including myself, based on misunderstanding, and that was wrong, so I stopped changing them. And now I find a lot of people are just changing the sadhana slightly because they like this language better than that, or they don't know this mantra, or they know that mantra.
Yeah.
So every once in a while, I decide that I'm going to teach from one because they're so accessible, and there's so many copies that have been fucked around it.
Right.
And I'm such a purist, you know, that every once in a while I just get on my hobby horse and I'm going to teach it the way it was taught to me and with the actual mantras that were, you know.
Yeah.
And what I was eventually taught after going to many, many teachers, well, this is what the offering bowls are, this is what, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After stumbling around and trying to figure, and then finally meeting somebody with... So I think that it's a question of, like, it's not a perfect world. And yeah, this is not the correct thing to do. On the other hand, there's a lot of misinformation. No, I'm saying what I think.
Mm-hmm. What is not the correct thing to do?
I'm saying what I think.
Yeah.
This is not the correct thing to do from the Tibetan point of view. Give a class to a bunch of people who aren't going to do the practice, and don't, I'm not giving the initiation, of a Tara practice, sadhana. I'm going to give as much teaching as I can to give people an understanding of what this actually represents. So that maybe if they meet a sadhana somewhere else, some of this might actually have a few seeds might have gone in. And maybe they will have a better sense of joy about not understanding, because maybe actually this whole thing is full of mystery. I remember somebody said something about that once, and that's not what I just thought at first. Maybe. So it's a question of, you know, damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah.
I think.
I'm not questioning the teaching of it, sorry. I guess my question is...
Did I say you were?
Well, it sounds like
it. No, it didn't. It sounded like I was telling you my question.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think I'm talking about you, you're not paying attention to me.
I am.
I am talking about me. I'm saying, this is one of my questions, and this is how I have gone with it.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I'm answering it as honestly as I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about you. Sharing with her. That's all. Okay? Thanks for your question. I quit. You know, is this beautiful gold light in your hearts? Absolutely gorgeous. It's just shining, this extremely beautiful light. It's just right there, just bubbling away inside your body, and the light just spreads through your belly. Spreads up to your shoulders. Spreads down to your hips, down your legs, down your arms. Pours out your pores, fills this room. This gold light just fills this room. Please don't close your eyes. I'll send my teeth over. Light just fills this whole room, fills the house. Moves through all of Ottawa. Anybody you want to pray for, moves through all of North America, the whole world. Anybody you want to pray for, just imagine them being washed by this light, your mom wearing. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind, just for a moment, it's just temporarily assuaged. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.
Thank you.